Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Conversations Live, where we bring you the best in music, books, entertainment, and current events. When the movers and shakers of the world have something to say to you, they say it to us. Now, here is your host, Cyrus Webb.
And welcome back, everyone, to Conversations Live. I'm your host, Cyrus Webb. Glad you all could join us once again. Stephen Caputi is making his first appearance on our program today to talk to us not only about his book, I Should Have Stayed in Morocco, but what it's been like for him to reflect on his life, reflect on his choices, and the way that his life has, I think, in many ways, been able to start a dialogue that all of us can benefit from. If you're just hearing about the book, we'll tell you how you can get the Kindle version today, but also when the print edition of the book will be available as well. Stephen, hello to you, and welcome to the program.
Hello, Cyrus. How are you?
I'm doing really well, Stephen. I really appreciate the time today. I was telling you before we went on here, you know, there were definitely some things that really struck me about your journey that I wanted to be able to talk about with our audience. But I first want to talk to you about the experience. I mean, the book was released the latter part of this year. I mean, what has it been like for you, first of all, to be able to share your story this way, but also to see the way that people are already responding to it?
Well, so far I've had a lot of good response. I wanted to tell the story because I wanted people to understand a few things, actually. I wanted to give the other side of the story about the Scott Rothstein Ponzi scheme. I would call it the human side of what happened.
Yeah. I mean,
much of what was written and read was posted all over the Internet, and you know, I think there have been other books written that are kind of like an encyclopedia of events, as opposed to getting the emotion across. So I wanted people to know what it was like to actually go through that and experience that, and what it was like in real time, what it felt like, what was going through our minds. I wanted to set the scenes. That would be number one. I also wanted to give a picture of what it was like in prison. You know, I had several unfortunate experiences while I was inside. It was nothing like what I expected. And I think a lot of people need to know and should know what's really going on behind closed doors, with the intention of doing something about it. Exactly what, I don't know yet, but I would like to use my experience to improve the system and to maybe make it easier for people that are going in the future.
Right. You know, I think there's just from what you just said, Stephen, there are two things I wanted to talk about. One is the reflection. And I think a lot of times we don't realize, you know, how deep we may be in a situation or even where we are until we kind of take a moment, look around, and really, you know, to reflect. Do you think that that is ironically, one of the good things that came from prison, was that you were able to do that?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, I had certainly had plenty of time to think about what happened and about the conditions precedent, how it all came to be, you know, the choices that I had made in my life that led up to that point. And, it's been pretty much a healing experience to relive it and rewrite it and portray it as it was and as it felt.
Right. And I think, too, the other side of that is I think you were living what many people would look at as being the dream life, you know, being able to have anything and everything kind of at your disposal. Do you hope that that's one of the things, too, Stephen, that people realize is what really is important, what really matters, and appreciating those things?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I had a good life even before I met Scott. You know, I've been very fortunate, very lucky my whole life. I grew up in a great family in a great neighborhood. I was an athlete in college. We had a lot of success. I had the good fortune of going to an Ivy League school, and I worked for all the best people in the hospitality business. I was in the restaurant and nightclub business pretty much all my life. So I'd had a pretty much a great life up until the time things had fell apart.
Right.
So it was all gradual. It didn't seem like, you know, one day I turned around and I had everything. You know, it just kept getting better and better and better. And my relationship with Scott started many, many years ago, I would say in the early 90s, when he was corporate counsel for a little company that I was the controller of. And we were handling all the company's legal affairs. And, you know, I got to know him and became his friend back when he was in a cubicle in the corner of Howard Kuznick's office. You know, before he was a big shot, before he had any money.
Right.
And, you know, I became his friend. And, you know, I was with him throughout the whole way, throughout his rise to stardom, so to speak. Although, you know, most of us that were involved ultimately did not really know what he was up to and what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not in any kind of detail. He was like a comic book character in a lot of ways. He only allowed people to know what he wanted them to know.
Right.
So, you know, the fables of everybody's participation are probably a little bit exaggerated, except for those on the inner circle, of which I really was an inner circle friend, but I wasn't really on the inner circle of the Ponzi scheme, so to speak.
Right. Right, and I think that is the thing. And, you know, I think there are so many great things that can come out of this that will help people, Stephen. And we'll talk about later why you decided to write the book. But for those who are just tuning in, either on the radio side or online, you're listening to Conversations Live. Stephen Caputi is our guest for this segment. He's the author of the new book, I Should Have Stayed in Morocco. He was able to tell not only his journey, but also, you know, what he's been able to learn. I want to read a bit of what you said in the book and then have you talk about that. And then, because I think it also goes to what we were saying about reflection. This is what you wrote, Stephen, in the book. Being in prison does something to the spirit of a man. I've never prayed so often before, and this moment was no exception. It helped me tolerate the process and distracted me from the humiliation and pain. I was trembling, in part because it was freezing, but with my head up this time, I was finally fitted with an orange jumpsuit, and just 2 hours after my kidnapping from the baseball field, I was standing in the middle of a 6x12 cell. While I was busy putting on my new orange ensemble, I overheard several of the guards and an administrator type clamoring back and forth about where to put me. They were confused and seemed to have conflicting orders. Do these people know anything? I wound up in a room labeled segregation, the euphemism that the Bureau of Prisons used for solidarity, as if it made it any less harsh. Now, in hearing those words, could you have imagined that your journey, that your life, and that your choices would have left you or led you to that place where you were?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, I was, it was a shocking experience. I mean, once the door slammed shut and I heard the clang of the shell of the door and the steel and the boots walking away, you know, I'm starting to tremble just thinking about it. That was a terrifying experience. And, it was incredible to me that I was standing there at the time. It was like almost a surreal experience. Like it wasn't really happening, but it was.
Right.
You know, it was like almost like watching a movie and being in the movie at the same time.
Right.
It was very strange, very weird. Plus, I'm claustrophobic by nature, you know, which did not help my situation at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it didn't take but 20 minutes when the walls started closing in on me.
Yeah.
And I just was just struck, stunned with the nothingness of it all. You know, going from having everything and then to nothing at all. I mean, not even a piece of paper, not a pen, not a book, not a matchstick, nothing.
Yeah.
It was just it was surreal.
So let's talk about the why, Stephen. I mean, why write and share? I know you said, you know, the journey itself, I mean, writing was, you know, a part of the experience, a part of the journey, and probably a part of the healing for you. But what made you say this is something that other people need to know about?
Well, several reasons. Once I got into a different cell and I was able to procure a cheap pen and some crumpled up pieces of paper, there was nothing else to do except for write. You know, so it just kind of formulated in my mind. I had nothing to do, and I was going through a mental checklist of what exactly should I do now? What could I do now? What can I do to pass the time? How can I convey my thoughts? So it dawned on me to start taking notes on exactly what was happening, just chronicling everything, every meal, every shower, every contact with the people in prison, and
right.
with other inmates as well, which there wasn't much contact.
Mm.
So that's how I got the idea. It was something to do, and it also helped me to get a handle on what I was feeling at the time, because I was still kind of in a state of shock, and it helped me deal with it.
Right. Did you go through a period, and I don't mean this to be disrespectful in any way, and I hope you know that, but did you go through a period, though, Stephen, that you thought that this could not happen to you?
Well, yeah, you mean after I was in?
Right.
Oh, absolutely. I was stunned at the at how I'd gone from having everything to down to having nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I lost all my money and my house and my savings. I had to live for a couple of years before I went in, without working. You know, I had a daughter in college and expenses and huge legal expenses and fees, and pretty much ground me down to nothing. So it was a gradual decline. But yeah, I had plenty of time to think about how it exactly came to be. And,
right.
Sure.
Yeah. Do you think that one of the lessons, because I think for our audience, whether they're joining us on the radio dial here, Stephen, in Mississippi, or online around the world, you know, I think that we all have been in situations where we have that whisper or that feeling about something. And some people would call it conscience, you know, and I think, you know, there are those moments where we have to make a choice. Do you feel as though this experience has really made you or helped you even to examine choices and the importance of those choices and the consequences that come with those choices?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The biggest lesson was the lesson of trust. You know, I trusted, let's face it, I trusted Scott. He was my friend. He was my attorney. Toward the end of our relationship, he was my business partner.
Mm-hmm.
And I trusted him unconditionally. And part of it was I was his friend. And I believed him and I believed in him. And I did not see him. I saw him as someone who was a pillar of the community. He was generous and kind and supportive and charitable. He was politically active. I mean, everybody trusted him. I was with him at Mar-a-Lago when they had fundraisers for John McCain at Donald Trump's place.
Mm-hmm.
The Don trusted him, and who's more credible than the Don?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a pillar. He ran with the governor, who was his personal friend. He was he hung with George Bush and Jeb Bush. The sheriff was his friend. Everybody was his friend. And it seemed as if everyone loved him everywhere we went. And it was an illusion, but it was also an illusion that I wanted to believe in. And
right.
In retrospect, I should have been more diligent about you know, about his meteoric rise to wealth. You know, and more suspicious, you know. But I fell in line with everybody else.
Right.
Everyone trusted him. I trusted him.
Yeah. Well, we actually read the title of the book in the very beginning of the prologue. I want to talk about something else, though, that I was not expecting, Stephen, when you were booked for this program. And when I started reading, you know, one of the things that you talk about, of course, is the prison system. And, you know, that for a lot of people will definitely get some attention. But, you know, because you've been on the inside, do you think that puts you in a unique position to be able to talk about the need for reform, the need for changing the way things are, and the need to reevaluate, you know, why it is that so many who come out of prison end up going back?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's more people that know the inside scoop than you think. You know, I had a lot of time to analyze and to research the history of the prison system, and because inquiring minds want to know.
Right.
So I did my homework, and I sent out and I did the research, and you know, there's over 11 million men that have been ground up by the system. You know, and that means that there's 11 million families that have been affected by the system. And no, the conditions are a lot harsher than people would imagine. Sometimes it seems to me like people just don't care because it doesn't affect them. You know, you get up, you go to work, you go about your business, and, you know, it really doesn't affect you too much that, you know, there's millions of guys that are underfed and undernourished and abused and basically made to feel as if they don't matter anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like a brainwashing process. You know, I describe it. The whole process and the whole, it seems like the MO, the goal of the prison system is the five Ds, demean, devalue, diminish, dehumanize, and destroy. Now, I don't really know if they do that, excuse me, on purpose. I certainly think they do, but... you know, the whole thing is created what I call a perpetual prisoner money machine. And private business is getting involved now, and the prison system is big business. It's billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar business in the United States. There's private prisons cropping up everywhere. It's a gigantic economy. There's conventions. There's 2,000 vendors to the Bureau of Prisons. And, you know, it's a machine, and it needs to be slowed down. People need to understand what's happening. You know, it's no surprise that there's 70 million people in this country who now have criminal records.
Yeah.
You know, and I just don't think that we woke up one day after going through the tail of a comet, and you know, we woke up as law-breaking infidels. You know, I don't think it happened that way. There's some kind of movement and force driving it, and it seems to me the biggest force behind it is profit, is money.
Right. You say in the book, when talking about some of the incidents that happened in prison, I want to read a bit of this, Stephen, and ask you a very important question about compassion. You wrote this: as soon as life and time permitted, I was going to do something for the victims of the BOP all across the country who had the misfortune of residing in the SHU. I was determined not to let the BOP further destroy the human element. I've devised a plan to use the churches and other religious organizations as the actual conduit and find a way to do something good for the guys in the SHU. If it was the last thing I did, maybe it would be. I didn't think the BOP would risk the potential bad press associated with saying no to do good organizations. I'd learned firsthand that many pernicious control organizations wanted to be viewed as humanitarians they weren't. They purport to be the kind and wonderful protectors of society who are really victims themselves for having to do such a tough and thankless job day in and day out, facing and dealing with the criminal scum of the earth, putting themselves on the line so that the good people of America could be safe and cozy in their homes. They went to great lengths to create the distinct impression that the top brass of the Bureau of Prisons were unsung valiant heroes. Yeah, right. You know, I want to talk to you about compassion. Do you feel as though that's one of the things that you developed through this experience? compassion for us.
And it was mostly because of the lack of compassion that I felt coming towards me. You know, you mentioned the SHU. That's a moniker for special housing units, which is the technical word for the hole. Okay, and the hole means pretty much solitary confinement. So, yeah, the conditions were terrible, and people need to understand and to know what's happening, because by the time a person gets out of prison, you know, for the most part, I surveyed a lot of people and did a lot of interviews while I was in, probably a couple thousand.
Right.
I visited 5 different properties during the course of my tour. And in my mind, the 4 to 5 year point was the line of demarcation, the line past which most of the guys would just give up and just become robots and give up their ambition of having a decent life. They just became robots, automatons. So I wanted to do something about it, and you know, I like I said, I still don't know quite what I'm going to do yet. I'm looking for some influential people that I'm reaching out right now to some people that would like to hopefully want to participate with me, because you know, I know there are concerned people in this country, you know, some of them politicians, some of them activists, and I would like to do something to alleviate the harsh conditions, because they're serving no one. It's a very destructive process.
Right. Right. Well, it's a lot that we can be able to gather from this book and from your journey, Stephen, and it's all because you had the courage to be able to share your story with us. Again, everyone, Stephen Caputi has been our guest for this segment. I Should Have Stayed in Morocco is the title of the new book. It is available right now through our friends at Amazon.com via Kindle. You can get it there for only $4.99. The print edition will be available on December the 15th, so make sure you guys bookmark it already on Amazon. If you'd rather have the print edition, go ahead and bookmark it there, so you all can be able to get the alert when it's available there. Stephen, when people finish the book, what is your hope? What do you want them to be able to know about you, know about your journey, and know about what's possible for them when they come out of whatever challenge or situation they might be in?
Well, first, I would want them to realize that trust does not have to be a four-letter word. I haven't given up on trust and on love, despite what happened to me. I learned a great deal from it. But the point being, you can't ever let your guard down. And even though you trust and you love, you still have to take proper precautions, and don't get carried away in a situation. Don't get swept away. You know, try to keep it real.
Right.
So that'd be one thing. You know, I don't hate Scott the way everybody thinks that I should, you know, and I'd like to see him again someday. I'd probably take a swing at him first off, and then I'd probably hug him, you know,
yeah,
because he was my friend, and I love my friends, and I'm not wired to hate my friends. You know, he wasn't always a master manipulating, scheming, cold-hearted crook and a scammer. You know, when I met him, he was kind and personable and funny, talented. He was a great friend. He was generous. Just a great guy to be with.
Right.
And, you know, at some point in time, he got twisted enough and he lost his compass, and it didn't matter to him that he was incriminating his friends and his partners and doing so much damage. You know, at some point in time, he lost his way. So it just proves that anybody can lose it. You know, and it's something to be on guard for.
Right.
Because the last thing you want to do is to get entrenched in something like I did, that you can't get out of, that just completely rips your life apart.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, what a great thing for us all to be able to learn from, Stephen. And it's because of a book like yours, I think, that we're able to do just that. Again, everyone, Stephen Caputi has been our guest. Make sure you all go to Stephen's website. It's stevecaputi.com, and I'll spell that. It's StevCaputi.com. And there you can find out more information about Stephen's journey and the book as well. Again, make sure you guys go ahead and get the Kindle edition that's available now. The print edition will be available on December the 15th. And Stephen, really appreciate the time. I'll be writing my review on Amazon.com. Encourage anyone else who's read the book to be able to do the same thing. And Stephen, I hope you'll stay connected with us and come back.
Well, it was my pleasure, really. Thank you for having me on. It's a difficult thing to talk about.
Sure.
Because I have such a vivid memory, and as I speak the words, I can envision being in the cell and being in the courtroom and being judged, yeah, and being vilified in the press and losing everything. And it's difficult to talk about, but people need to know. And like I said, I made a promise to myself when I was gone to make something good happen out of this, and
right,
I'm going to follow through on that.
Yeah, and we're definitely glad that you're doing that and sharing that with us as well. And wishing you nothing but the best, Stephen, and definitely, again, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, Cyrus. Take care.
You're more than welcome. And we thank you, our audience, for joining us for another great segment of Conversations Live. If you all came in late and you missed part of the conversation, don't worry. Thanks to our online friends, you all can catch the replay right after we go off the air. Until next time, I'm your host, Cyrus Webb, saying, as always, enjoy your day, enjoy your life, enjoy your world. Make sure you take out time to enjoy some good music, as well as a great book. Thank you all for choosing Conversations Live today. You all make it a great one.